It's your life, your health, it's your show. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, with Joe Galewski and Dr. Deb Lonser, and starring Dr. Michael Roizen, MD.
Today's show brought to you by YouBeauty.com and Morning and Night Multivitamins, udocs@gmail.com, youdocs@gmail.com. And on the phone, 877-711-5211. If you miss a segment, RadioMD.com. Miss a guest, miss a topic, miss a Real Age Tip of the Week. You never miss it. RadioMD.com. There's a compound, Dr. Mike, in red meat and maybe energy drinks that could be linked to heart disease. So says research from your beloved Cleveland Clinic. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is very interesting because they're dueling, literally warring clinics. Mayo Clinic just had a study this week, a week later, which showed that short-term use, there was a study that was looking at prior studies and said short-term use of L-carnitine after a heart attack seems to decrease death rate by about 27%. The carnitine study that Stan Hazen did at the Cleveland Clinic showed that if you ate more than one portion of red meat or took carnitine supplements regularly, you produced a compound, TMAO, which was five times more likely on a milligram per milligram basis to cause heart disease than is cholesterol or to be associated with heart disease. TMAO is a thing produced by the bacteria in your gut. And what you really are doing when you take red meat is you induce the bacteria in your gut to change how they metabolize stuff, so you produce this TMAO. Vegans, when fed red meat or carnitine supplements, did not produce this. So what the two studies together, I take it, show is that short-term use of L-carnitine boosts energy production. That helps your heart function. Long-term, it causes arterial disease, causes inflammation in your arteries. So the difference is, if you've had a heart attack, short-term L-carnitine may improve muscle function, your heart muscle function, and decrease your risk of dying in the short term after a heart attack. Long-term usage of it and long-term chronic usage increases heart disease risk. So L-carnitine is like cocaine in that way. Short-term use, you feel great. Long-term, kills you.
And the same for energy drinks? Energy drinks mentioned in the Cleveland Clinic research.
Well, many energy drinks say they have other substances in there or have amino acids in there or proteins in there. And many of them, when Stan Hazen and his team analyzed them, actually had carnitine in there. And it's even in some coffees that you buy in the coffee shop. So people have wondered why the coffee in the coffee shop tastes so much better or seems to give them more energy than the coffee they brew at home. Well, it's this L-carnitine and lecithin, both of which cause liver inflammation and heart disease in the long term. So long term meaning 10 or 20 years, short term meaning 2 months to 3 months.
Now, while we're talking about drinks, this week I read a little piece that study about sugary soda, sugary drinks that might blow a hole in Mayor Mike Bloomberg's theory about soda consumption. A new study has found that we not only love to drink soda, but will buy more when serving sizes are restricted. They found that restricting larger servings of sodas to moderate them may actually encourage people to buy more. So if you get rid of extra large cups, this study seems to say that people will just get more refills. What do you make of that?
Well, maybe we should force people to get 48 ounces or more.
Well,
so
it's like
get a small cup.
It's like the forbidden fruit theory, right? If it's forbidden, it's like if you can't have it, you want more of it. Now, remember the vending machines years ago when you were a kid? Generally, when you get a soda from a machine, it was, 7 or 8 ounces. And then because of marketing, soda cans grew to 12, then to 16. And now today, a typical can or bottle is even 20, even 24 ounces. And the nutritional information on these cans, Mike, clearly states a bottle or can contains two servings. But, you know, we don't treat it that way, do we?
And, in fact, with a sugar drink, once you get over about 2 ounces of it in an hour,
yeah,
your blood sugar goes over the level that triggers arterial disease. So a small amount of sugar, fine, or even a small amount, or even a regular amount, if you've had some walnuts or something like that 30 minutes beforehand, so you've slowed your stomach emptying, that's fine. But a full regular soda, you're likely to do yourself damage, more damage than any psychological benefit, and the damage lasts a long time. So food is not, let's make a deal. You change your proteins with that sugar. So we often measure hemoglobin A1C in diabetics. All that is a glucose or sugar at the A1C position. What that does is it stops that hemoglobin from releasing oxygen normally. When your blood sugar gets above a certain level, 110 in for coronaries or for blood vessels to your heart, you put that sugar on the grout inside your coronary arteries, and that leads to damage to your, or makes it much more likely you'll get damage to your arteries with a fatty streak. So food is not, let's make a deal, or the other way of saying it is, food is much more than calories. Calories do count for obesity, but food has nutrients in it and other things that can affect the way your genes and you function.
I think there's a feeling among a lot of people, too, that, you know, when it comes to these big drinks, they think might, you know, they think, hey, I bought it, and I'm not going to waste it. I think that feeling is prevalent. I think a smaller serving would reduce consumption. I mean, the study quoted here, as I understand it, only gives a bargain appearance to the options and therefore the larger buy. I think if 7-Eleven stopped, or, you know, a convenience store stopped selling 64-ounce containers, I think people would live with the alternatives, don't you?
I absolutely think they would live with the alternatives. We did for many years, you know.
Oh, yeah. That's
right?
What I'm saying.
It's only,
yeah,
it's only a recent invention, meaning since the 1980s, that we've had such huge gulps of soda.
Yeah, right. Okay, 30 is really 45. That's interesting because now they're saying 60 is the new 40 or 70 is the new 50, but is that really true? Is 30 now really the new 45?
Well, this was a study, and I'm going to have to find the country. I want to say the Netherlands, but I may be wrong in the country, so I'm going to look it up, where they looked at a whole bunch of people who were 30 years old. And they looked at their blood pressure. They looked at their obesity rates. They looked at their cigarette smoking. They looked at their cholesterols, etc. And it was in the Netherlands, and they looked at, I think it was 6,000 adults. And what they found from a characteristic of glucose, blood pressure, obesity, etc., was that they, and even including the cigarettes, that they were of the same disease risk prevalence as someone 15 years older, or what we call their real age of the 30-year-olds in the Netherlands was the equivalent of 45 or 15 years older than their calendar age. And this had gotten progressively older over a period of time. Now, when you say 60 is the new 40, on the other hand, 60-year-olds were getting healthier in the other study where we say 60 is the new 40 and had the health risks the 70-year-old or 60-year-old of 20 years ago had the health risks of the 40-year-old of 50 years ago. That's what that data is from.
Wow. We
so
will...
You can modify it, and as you know, that's a very important component of how competitive the nations are as countries.
All right, guest time coming up right after the break. It's John Wendell. John is the husband of Susan Spencer Wendell. And her book is called Until I Say Goodbye, My Year of Living with Joy, published by HarperCollins. John Wendell in the guest segment coming up right after the break on You, the Owner's Manual radio show with Dr. Michael Roizen right here on Radio MD. Stay well, and thanks for listening.